As you begin this long journey of recovery, your city is with you. Your Commonwealth is with you. Your country is with you. We will all be with you as you learn to stand and walk and, yes, run again. Of that, I have no doubt you will run again.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron, it's been a very somber week.
Somber was exactly the word that was on my mind. The president, in what we just heard, speaking at the prayer service that was held in Boston on Thursday. That was just, of course, a few days after the shocking bombing that ended the Boston Marathon.
Of course, this is not supposed to be a political conversation. And if it were up to us, it would certainly not be a political conversation. Sometimes when we go back to previous tragedies, we think of Oklahoma City in 1995 and we think of 9/11. Democrats and Republicans came together, but it seems to be almost immediately a desire to politicize what happened in Boston, not to ascribe blame yet, but to say, like, for example, I did see that Steny Hoyer and Javier Becerra talking about that perhaps first responders may be hurt and hampered by the sequester. And so perhaps maybe that was a little political. When President Obama said this is a terrible tragedy, Bill O'Reilly of Fox came on and said, it's not a terrible tragedy. I mean, it's, you know, it's more awful than that. When President Obama didn't say the word terrorism the first day, everybody was jumping up and down as if that lessened or diminished the importance and the ugliness of what happened. It just seemed like it's okay to mourn. It's okay to just hold our children. It's okay to, you know, just talk about the horror of the whole thing and not put it in political terms. And it seems like for many of us, we're incapable of doing that.
Even for political junkies like you and me, I think we still feel like there needs to be a dimension beyond what is political, what is partisan political at any rate. I mean, surely there will come a time when people will refer to this incident and put it into some sort of a political context. But to have people arguing about it in the terms you just described in the first hours after the event, that was distasteful. I think a lot of it is driven by the habit that a lot of political people get into of trying to find an angle, trying to find an edge in absolutely everything that happens. And also a lot of the habits that we have in the media of trying to take it into the political dimension as quickly as we can.
Certainly not to make light of this at all, but the thought of the Yankees and the Boston Red Sox at Yankee Stadium the other day when they honored Boston and did a Sweet Caroline, which is the Red Sox theme song. The point is, if Yankees and Red Sox can get along, Democrats and Republicans can get along too, at least for a little bit.
For some people, the tragedy in Boston was compounded by what they saw as the tragic events in the Senate, where every amendment that was attempting to make the gun bill, the restraint of gun violence, or if you will, the gun control bill of 2013, somehow passable, somehow enactable, was defeated. The Senate had determined that it would require 60 votes for any of these amendments to be adopted. And that was, of course, in anticipation of the belief that some senators would filibuster the bill eventually. And so everything that was substantive in it would have to be able to pass the 60-vote muster. So they had a big vote on the amendment proposed by Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Democrat, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, Republican, that would have made background checks more or less universal. This was the one thing that many gun control advocates thought they might be able to salvage from all of this debate after Newtown. They knew they weren't going to get an assault weapons ban. They knew they weren't going to get some of the other tougher stuff they wanted, including gun magazines. So they were going for background checks. And when they had the big vote before Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid switched his vote for procedural reasons, they had 55 votes in favor of the Manchin-Toomey-Toomey-Manchin provision. 55 was, of course, far short of 60.
The vote on this vote, the yeas are 54, the nays are 46. Under the previous order requiring 60 votes for the adoption of this amendment, the amendment is not agreed to.
That, of course, was Vice President Biden, who was presiding over the Senate at the time that they took that particular vote.
The emotion was apparent not only in the senators' faces as they took their vote, but in the Senate gallery as well. There were many victims' families attending the vote, and, of course, for many of them, it was just an unbelievable disappointment.
The order in the Senate, the gallery will refrain from any demonstration or comment.
You know, a week ago, when the Senate voted with 68 votes to begin debate on the gun bill, people were saying there's some hope out there. This is not a filibuster. They were hoping to reach 60 after Toomey and Manchin offered their compromise. 68 senators came forward and said, let's go ahead with this debate. And a lot of people saying, well, maybe something can actually get done. It won't be the assault weapons ban, certainly. It won't be, as you say, the limiting the magazine, the size of the magazine. But it certainly would be, if nothing else, universal background checks. And Pat Toomey and Joe Manchin, both very pro-gun lawmakers.
A ratings from the NRA.
Absolutely. They said, look, this is not gun control. This is common sense. And they thought that there would be enough to carry the day. And yet, when you saw the vote after the vote after the vote, even Toomey and Manchin, who, again, are no bleeding heart gun opponents, couldn't get more than 55 votes. And President Obama was, of course, livid, and he let the Senate have it.
One common argument I heard was that this legislation wouldn't prevent all future massacres. And that's true. As I said from the start, no single piece of legislation can stop every act of violence and evil. We learned that tragically just 2 days ago. But if action by Congress could have saved one person, one child, a few hundred, a few thousand, if it could have prevented those people from losing their lives to gun violence in the future while preserving our Second Amendment rights, we had an obligation to try. And this legislation met that test. And too many senators failed theirs.
Some people are saying that because of the way the Senate voted, maybe the uproar in the country will force the Senate to come back and get a second chance at this vote. But if Sandy Hook and the horrors of what happened to watch these young children massacred, if the horror of something like that was not enough to make a difference in the Senate, I can't see what speech that President Obama could make, what money that Michael Bloomberg could raise. I can't see how anything changes.
What were the reasons? Why did 45 senators vote on the initial vote not to accept universal background checks?
Well, there were four Democrats who voted against it. It was Mark Begich of Alaska. It was Mark Pryor of Arkansas. It was Max Baucus of Montana. And it was Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Other than Heidi Heitkamp, the first three gentlemen are up for a re-election in 2014, apparently in certainly very strong red states. You know, they're obviously nervous about voting for any kind of gun legislation.
Anything that says gun legislation.
Right, exactly.
And these are four states, by the way, that have how much population combined?
Well,
Arkansas has a few congressional districts, but the others, if I'm not mistaken, all have the minimum one House seat. Montana and Alaska and North Dakota. So in other words, these are three or four of the least populated states in the country.
That's true. And these are states where, of course, hunting and guns are very popular. These are states that Mitt Romney overwhelmingly carried.
I think the average was 18%.
Yeah, the margin. So there was also that. Now, there were also some Republicans. There were only four Republicans who voted for it. And they were Pat Toomey, of course, one of the co-sponsors. John McCain of Arizona, who's not up for re-election.
Kind of interesting given the Arizona guns history.
Right. Maybe that was part of it, although Jeff Flake voted against it.
The other way, yes.
Right. And Jeff Flake is very close with Gabby Giffords and her husband.
That's right.
But Jeff Flake voted no. Mark Kirk, who is not up for re-election anytime soon, and Susan Collins, who is in a state that, for all we know, could provide a conservative alternative to Susan Collins, but she remains very popular. But there's no way to lump these four Republicans. You had the conservative Pat Toomey, you had a pretty conservative John McCain, you had a moderate Mark Kirk, and you had a moderate liberal Susan Collins. Look, I think this vote did show two diametrically opposed cultures in this country on the issue of guns and the feeling, the emotion about guns.
And I think it's worth saying that 90% of the people in one party in the Senate, 90% of the Republicans, were with the more traditional Second Amendment paramount culture that you're describing, and 90% of the Democrats on the other side were willing to have universal background checks. Now, they may not be willing to go much further, many of those Democrats, but they were at least willing to be with the president that far. So, to pose the political question, will this vote that happened this week and this apparent, you know, basically spike in this gun bill, which we see going nowhere at this point, will this be an issue in 2014? Will it be an issue in the presidential primaries or the presidential election of 2016?
Well, I think we know how Democrats feel, and I think we know how Republicans feel. And I think another thing that we're not talking about is that for all this hand-wringing and emotion that went on in the Senate, it's very possible that it could have gone to the House, and the House said, we're not doing it. For all we know, part of the calculation of some of the senators could have been that, well, you know, why risk our political future, which is no profiles in courage, but having said that, if the House is not going to go along with it.
That's right. It's a wasted vote. And we've seen the House members many times say, why should we throw ourselves on the pyre of history if the Senate isn't even going to vote on this particular issue? And the Senate has done that to the House on a number of occasions with some kind of a difficult issue, with some kind of a tough vote.
A similar thing is going on like that with the issue of immigration. The Senate, of course, is the Gang of Eight, have apparently reached a compromise. I think there's no bigger spotlight on anyone more than Marco Rubio, because elected with Tea Party support in 2010. He is certainly looking at 2016 for a possible presidential run. And being Latino from a key state of Florida, people, especially conservatives, are looking to him for leadership. He has been very, very careful in his deliberations and what he's had to say, but what he says makes a big difference. Now, one would have thought that having Manchin and Toomey on guns would have been enough to bring a lot of pro-gun folks over to that background check. That didn't happen. We still have to wait and see whether what Marco Rubio has to say and his leadership on the immigration issue, whether that brings both conservatives in the Senate and a very wary House, who are still talking about amnesty and things like that, where they go.
Yes, indeed. Well, I suspect that the Republican majority in the House, most of those Republicans will not vote for whatever comes out of the Senate on immigration. But something will come out of the Senate on immigration, because as far as I have heard, there is no filibuster threat, and there clearly will be a simple majority for the Gang of Eight's compromise. There may even be 60 votes or 65 votes or even more votes for that Gang of Eight compromise, which is a surprise when you consider where the Republican Party appeared to be just a year ago during its presidential primaries. But we had the election in November. More than 70% of Hispanics voted for Obama. More than 70% of Asian Americans, a smaller group but a growing group, they also voted for Obama. That, I think, really sent a strong message to the average Republican politician that the future was arriving rather quickly with respect to immigration and with respect to these particular issues, and they had to switch their position. So I believe these politicians know how to do math.
You know, we've talked about key issues like immigration. We've talked about key issues like guns. What the American people don't seem to be talking about and probably should be talking about is the issue of trespassing.
Yes. I think it's been a tragedy in our national
life
that people can't just keep their feet off somebody else's property, or in this case, coffee table. And I think that if somebody needs to get into a particular domicile and watch the Super Bowl, they shouldn't do it if there's a court order telling them not to.
I think the thought of a 14-year-old child watching the second half of a Super Bowl by himself...
That's a national tragedy.
No, of course, exactly. So, of course, what you're talking about is Mark Sanford.
Oh, this is a Mark Sanford reference.
Yes, it is. Mark Sanford.
I think this is a really cheap way to back into talking about Mark Sanford.
Nothing is too cheap for us in the podcast.
This would be
cheap. That's why they call it It's All Politics. And, of course, we learned...
That's why they call it the Mark Sanford Show.
Yeah, okay. Well, actually, this was a story about Sanford and Son. Yes. Boy, I just thought of that now. So Mark Sanford, as we learned this week, apparently has this no trespassing agreement with his ex-wife, Jenny Sanford.
Well, this is not unfamiliar.
No, no, no.
Divorce cases.
No, not at all.
You shouldn't come into the house that your former spouse owns and lives in.
The story that he gave was that he tried to contact her, tried to say that he wanted to be with his son. Of course, I don't know why he couldn't be with his son.
For the first half of the Super Bowl?
For the first half. Well, you know something? That blackout was very frightening.
It was frightening.
It was.
I was frightened.
That's why I was with you. So anyway, so he's leaving after the game with a flashlight because all the lights are out.
It was his cell phone.
His cell phone, right. A cell phone
light.
He was
using it as a flashlight.
Right.
And, which works much better than trying to go the other way around.
And who comes to greet him but Jenny Sanford, who files a complaint.
Yes.
Now, apparently, this has happened several times.
Oh, dear.
This is not a Super Bowl-only
issue. I was hoping it was a Super Bowl-only issue.
And the big news of the week, of course, is that the NRCC has said we're getting out of this race.
That's the National Republican Congressional Campaign. When they walk away, they're saying two things. One, you're not going to get any more of our money, or the money of people whose contributions we direct. And number two, it's saying we think you are a loser.
Well, do you remember when the NRSC, the Senate Committee, did that with Todd Akin? They said, we're out of here.
Yeah.
And you know something? This, again, we're talking about this over and over again. This is a district. This is the first congressional district in South Carolina that Mitt Romney carried with
60.
58, right, 58 to 40, 18 percentage points. Elizabeth Colbert Bush could win this. It's a May 7th general election. She could win it.
Yeah.
And can I just say one thing? One of the things has always been key about this election is Jenny Sanford. Now, Jenny Sanford, we don't know if she tried to sabotage Mark Sanford, but the point is, if you alienate, if you hurt Jenny Sanford any more than you have, that is just wrong, and the voters know it. They feel it very strongly, and whether she's rejoicing in what's going on or not, but the point is, we were always going to wait to see if she was going to make any kind of signal, any kind of expression of displeasure. I don't know if this was deliberate or not.
Well, somebody allowed somebody to see what was in the sealed case file in a family court case, and that, it, you know, one suspicion would be that it was somebody involved in the family. But it was not as though she went out and had a news conference and said, right, Mark keeps showing up at the beach house. It was not as though she had gone out and done a really obvious torpedo on him. But maybe in a sense, this is more effective in terms of isolating him. There are at least two categories of voters who are going to be less likely to vote for him now. People who sympathize, as you have said, with Jenny Sanford and really, you know, disapprove of his treatment of her as his wife. And then another category of people would be evangelical Christians and other religious conservatives who look at him and say, he's just not a model that we want to have for our children in our district as a public official. And so these people aren't going to vote for Elizabeth Colbert Bush. They're going to just stay home and then come out again in another year and a half in another Republican primary in another general election and elect a Republican to replace Elizabeth Colbert Bush after a very short period of time.
You know, one of the things that also came out was the fact that Mark Sanford brought his two teenage sons to his primary victory party along with his Argentinian girlfriend.
Fiancé.
Well, fiancé now, yes. But the point is that apparently, according to sources close to Jenny Sanford, this upset the boys quite a bit. So there are
not that they got to go, but that she was there.
Well, that she was there. It was the first time I think that the boys and the woman were in the same place. How about this scenario? Elizabeth Colbert Bush wins the May 7th special election in 2014. Jenny Sanford is the Republican nominee against her. That would be fun.
That would be fun. It could happen. This is a drama that apparently isn't just going to keep on keeping on and continuing to provide material for our podcast, as is another former member of the United States House of Representatives from the state of New York.
Yes, I wish you didn't use the word member, but I do understand what you're saying. Anthony Weiner, of course, is very seriously thinking. Of course, he's always been thinking about running for mayor.
He's very seriously thinking.
Yeah, well, not all the time, clearly. But, of course, having run for mayor in 2005 and did fairly well in the Democratic primary, was going to run again in 2009.
And he was considered a pretty strong candidate.
And he was the front runner in 2013 until Twittergate happened, or Wienergate, or whatever. I mean, if you look at the New York Post headlines,
some kind of gate left open.
Exactly, right. And yet, he does have $4.3 million or more in his campaign account.
He's just burning a hole in his pocket.
Well, I think that was his problem from the beginning. But more importantly, the fact is that a new NBC Marist poll comes out and says that they expect him to hit 61 home runs in 1961.
Amazing. Marist poll always shows that, though. Have you noticed that?
I'm sorry. That was the Marist poll. I'm sorry. But the Marist poll shows Weiner a strong second in the primary to Christine Quinn, who's the Speaker of the City Council. Now, here's what I think. First of all, Anthony Weiner does not have a campaign staff. He has not hired anybody yet, although he has hired people to do a poll and things like that. But it reminds me of Gary Hart. When Gary Hart dropped out of the race in 87 and then decided, because none of the candidates were good enough, he came back and
they weren't addressing the issues that he cared
the
about.
Key, exactly. They did not address the key issues. And he came back in December of 1987. And when he announced that he was coming back, he was a front runner.
Briefly.
Well, yes, very briefly, because everybody knows who Gary Hart is. But the more they thought about Gary Hart, they didn't think about Soviet expansionism or new ideas. They thought about Gary Hart.
Yes.
For all the new ideas that Anthony Weiner may have, he wants to revitalize the police department, he wants universal health care, he wants to do all these things. I think ultimately it will be the front pages of the tabloids reminding voters, as if they need a reminding, what he did, how he humiliated his wife, who is staying with him, by the way.
She is still with
him. She is. And
she's right there on the cover of the New York Times Sunday magazine with him.
Do I think he's going to run? I do. Do I think he thinks that the issues are more important than Anthony Weiner? I think he believes that, but I don't think that he's going to succeed at all.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.